Now, our next speaker is intentionally, I have put him in our final slot, which is a rough assignment for any speaker. But the reason is that he comes packed with take-home value. For anybody who's a member of an investment team or anybody who is in a role where they're trying to help investment teams, Michael Falk is a partner with Focus Consulting Group, and he specializes in helping investment teams improve their decision-making. He also helps investment firms with strategic planning and firm succession. Historically, he has been there and done that in that he's been a chief strategist on a global macro hedge fund and a CIO in charge of manager due diligence and asset allocation for a multi-billion dollar advisory firm. He's also an author of three books, one of which has just come out, and he'll tell you about that. But today he's going to share with us some of his most meaningful observations having worked with effective and less effective investment teams all around the world. Michael.
Thank you, Claire. So the title of this little talk, The Seven Habits, Highly Effective Investment Teams, I've got to bring Claire into this because she was party to this titling as we're talking about. Well, let me take a quick step back just for fun. What is it I do? I go live with investment teams. 3-4 days at a crack. I become one of the team members. I'm in their office for 3-4 days. I watch, I observe, I interview. I have conversations. I have a diagnostic session. So in my gazillion years of experience, I also studied behavior for about a decade. So mix that in with the other investment background material. So Claire's like, well, Michael, when you do what you do, when you go live with a team, is there a process? I said, oh, yeah, I got steps, 5 to 7, however you want to count. Seven. The seven habits. I'm like, oh, please, not Stephen Covey. That's not fun. So when I started thinking about building this talk, thought, seven, this is going to rest. We're talking behavior, right? We're talking habits. So when you think of the number seven and you think of behavior and habits, what is the first thing that comes to mind? These seven characters. And you know, these seven characters exist on your team. They may not look the same way, but they behave the same way. So what I decided to do, and it was the last session of the day, so can we please have a little fun, or at least try, is what if we actually personify the seven different things that we do, and we give it an actual persona, and we bring that into the topic of habit. So what you're going to get in 45 minutes is a distillation of the last, 7 years and the literally dozens of teams I've gone to live with around the world covering virtually every asset class. Oh my, do I have inside information. But we're not going to go there. So you know these characters. So can we all do this together? Are you ready? Hi-ho, hi-ho. It's off to generate some alpha. You go. What do we do with this? Where does it start? Idea generation. The first part, whether it's quantitative, whether it's fundamental, it's a blend of both, is idea generation. Where do the idea generations come from? Right? You have some level of turnover in your portfolio. You actually have to turn over how many rocks to find an investable idea. I can actually do real quick productivity estimate on how many things you have to look at before you get an investable idea to satisfy your portfolio's needs. Then I can divide by the number of team members and say, hey, how is it possible you can do this? So a lot of teams are using quantitative front ends, screens, filters. Make sense? Some people don't stop there and the quant keeps going. But it can't be sleepy. But let's take this another step, because the concept here is continuous improvement. What is your fishing pond? Where do you go look for ideas? I want to know about your pond, because your pond is your philosophy. I can test it as your philosophy. I can test your pond to find out the efficacy of your philosophy. I can take your results in portfolios and I can compare them from the entirety of the opportunity set of what was in your pond. You say, Michael, we do this assessment, we do this assessment, we get down to 400 securities that make our pond. Fantastic. You invest in 50. Do you know the theoretical or synthetic peer group of every 50 stock portfolio you could have created out of the 400? Until you know that, how do you know how to get better? There's a way to check on how you actually do your research and how you're making buy decisions. What could you have fished, but you didn't? The path not taken. When you do a screen, do you ever examine the trash, the stuff you throw away? Or are you in that cognitive tunnel we heard about earlier today and it's only what you can accept? When are your fish best and worst? You know, sometimes it's a bad piece of fish. We don't want to talk about that. Why does this matter? If you have a consistent philosophy, you're going to go through high and low periods in your results. It's nature of the beast. Do you know when to expect the differential periods of performance? And if you have any reasonable expectation, are you doing anything to mitigate those? How significant is your pond? Right? If I slice and dice all the fish in your pond into quintiles on whatever characteristics that you're fishing for that makes sense for your philosophy, are the quintiles monotonic? Fancy word, no. Do the quintiles either slice up or down directionally and there's no break? What is the efficacy of your philosophy? When we talk about continuous improvement, we talk about testing everything. Research is so sensitive, I think that's like sneezing. Right? What's floating around in the air? What's affecting me? That's research. So I ask teams, how do your people do research? I meet the analysts, I meet the PMs, I meet the CIO. Do you have a template? Well, we don't want to do that. We don't want to constrain people. I said, okay, you have certain factors that are required. Well, kind of, sort of. Do they know what your definitions are? Any value investors in the room? I know there's at least one. Anybody who buys quality in the room? Does your team know how you're defining those terms? Because otherwise the research is not being done right. Not being done directionally correct. But why is this important? Idea generation, research, right? It's less standardized and it's very individual. People build their models differently. People look for different things in corporate management. Do you forecast? Some teams say yes, some teams say no. I say, really, you don't forecast? And how do you buy anything? Oh, but Michael, we don't forecast. We don't put a price target out there. So you just say, I think it's going to go up? We're talking about decision processes all day today, right? How do you make a decision without an expectation? An expectation is your forecast, whether you write it down or you don't. Do you do scenario planning? Is it just models? DCFs, I love this when people do DCFs these days. All right, you got to forgive me for a second. How do you do a DCF when the 10-year is at 2%? How do you do that? Oh, and by the way, it's like that all around the world. Oh, and by the way, they may never actually rise again, rates. So that's a separate dialogue. How do you do a DCF and not come up with an incredibly odd calculation? Why, how, when, and confidence. Teams hate it when I do this to them, so I'll do it to you. Let's see if you hate it also. You produce a recommendation to buy something. Fair? Yes? Just say yes or nod. Thank you. Why do you buy it? This would be your expectation of what you think the value is. How is it going to become true in the market, also known as what's the catalyst? What's going to drive that stock or bond to the value you think it's going to go to? When is it going to happen? And what probability would you assign? If you don't have those four things, what I will tell you is you don't have enough trackable data. You have those four things. Over time, you can track that. You can find out how good of a forecaster you are or not. You can compute what's called a Breyer score. And if you can compute whether or not you're good at forecasting, you know what that means? You can get better at it. And if we're talking about continuous improvement, why wouldn't we? And I say, teams say, well, Michael, we don't write this stuff down. Why not? Well, because we never get it right. Well, that would be important to know. We don't have the how, the why. They're like, well, this confidence thing, we're always confident. We just heard you. Overconfidence isn't a bad thing. It's not. How many restaurants, when they opened last 5 years? Folks, if we didn't have overconfidence in this world, we wouldn't have a place to go eat. Think about this for we ascribe all these biases as evil. No. We just have to be able to manage them. Confidence. Would any of you invest in anything that's worse than a coin toss? Shout it out when you know the answer. No! What is the matter? Claire, wake these people up. That would be a 50% level of confidence. Everybody with me? 50. Thank you. 60, 70, 80, 90. I count 1 to 5. Why do I not go to 100% confidence? Because none of us ever have complete information. Give it a rating of 1 to 5. I just want you to score it. And over time, we can see how your confidence correlates with the accuracy of your forecasts. If I want to have a lot of fun, I also want you to score, when you're doing the research, handing the recommendation, your level of emotionality. Ooh, now we're getting sophisticated. All I want to know is, are you highly emotional or not so much? I want binary, 0 or 1. That's all I want to know. And over time, I want to find out if your emotionality correlates with your confidence level. There is so much information we can learn from in the work we do, and we're not even scratching the surface. I find a lot of managers that make their best decisions when their confidence numbers are 60 or 70, 2 or 3, not when they're 4 or 5. I find that some other managers, when there are 4 or 5 on confidence, they're much better than when there are 2 or 3. Wouldn't you like to know that about yourself? Because we're not all the same. Vetting. This doesn't work in Asia. This doesn't work well in Eastern Canada. Western Canada, it's okay. Vetting. Somebody's coming to the team with a recommendation. How is the team going to make that recommendation that much better? This is the vetting process, or for my Canadian friends, process. This is what we're talking about. We're talking about a team helping to improve the recommendation. Why? Because they're not all the same person. They see things differently. We're going to come back to that. People's voices need to be heard. Here's a simple, simple thing. The newest, the most junior on the team speaks first. The most experienced or a leader of the team speaks last. You want to get more dialogue, more voices? There are easy ways to do this. Effective candor is necessary. What is effective candor? Separating fact and story. Effective candor. Sharing a truth, owning it, and disagreeing without being disagreeable. Can I just say I see it differently? This is where language, we've talked about language today. Language is really, really powerful. when it's used well. The words matter. Separating fact from story. There's no reason to get emotional and argumentative about facts. They're just facts. They're just lying there. They're details. What we get charged up about are stories. So you want to pull apart and know what is fact and what is story. Debate the stories because nobody has the right answer. You don't have to debate the facts. Candor around stories is really important. Otherwise, you can't pull them apart. Pre-mortems we just heard about. Do these. Rotate a devil's advocate. Have somebody assigned on the team to take the opposite side. They are not there simply to poke holes in the recommendation. They're there to stop the recommendation from becoming a portfolio position. That's their job. And rotate the role, because nobody should always be painted with that brush. This is a different muscle to exercise, folks. Buying is the happy culmination. Because you're all so happy when you buy things, right? This is the nature of the business. In fact, it's an unfortunate default that you have to buy things. Shouldn't be a default. Independent, non-conforming votes. You've got the recommendation. You've got the team. You've got a devil's advocate. Now we want to have a vote to see if this idea passes muster and should get bought. The devil's advocate does not vote, because we know what their vote is. The person who recommends the security doesn't vote, because they are way too biased. They just spent the last 2 months putting this report together. The rest of the team votes. Right? We can talk about various decision rights, but the vote has to be private. So, we say it's time to vote. Everybody around the table, if you don't have software for this, we use software. We have a little device, you vote, and we see the votes on the screen. Write down your vote. Then after everybody's written down their votes, they read them aloud and find out if it passed or failed the voting, the decision right decided upon. Why take that silly little step? Wipes out conformity bias. Wipes out the strong voices in the room. And only the dispassionate jurors, not the recommender, not the devil's advocate, get a vote. We can make the process of voting better, less biased. Silly little thing, but have you thought about it? What's the decision right? Does it have to be consensus? Can it be majority vote? Is it 2 out of 4 or 3 out of 4? Whatever the case is. You should know the decision right in advance. You don't change the rules after the game has begun. And what you're going to find out about the younger members of your team, they don't care as much about having a vote as they do having a voice. I think panelists in the last panel talked about that if you have diversity on the team, you can't sideline them when the important discussion. No. You need to leverage that diversity. I'll come back to that. Track the rationales. People vote for or against and why? Track it all. Track each of the individual decisions on the team. Your performance that you get compensated on, it's so unfortunate. The biggest incentive, we talked about that today, the biggest incentive in the room is comp. When you buy a security and put it in your portfolio, do you have any control over what it does after you've bought it? I see a head shaking. That is correct. No, you have no control. The only thing you control are your decisions, the inputs. You have no control over the output. So start to measure all of the inputs and what each member of your team, how good they are at making a future decision. Sizing is just dopey. And I don't mean dope. I mean dopey. If there is one part of portfolio construction or processes that is almost vacant with almost every team I meet with, they don't have a sizing discipline. Oh, I know what you're thinking. We do. If you tell me it's based on conviction, I will smack you. Do you actually have a sizing discipline? The irony here, so I think Brian said it on the last panel, right? Some of the quantitative things are just ahead. Do you know how hideously successful equal weighting is within the average portfolio? Not for everybody. Some people are good at active sizing, but they're in the minority. You know what people are good at? Finding good securities to buy. Let me change the venue. How many of you have more than one child? Show of hands, right? Which one is your favorite? Careful. The point here is you found a bunch of great securities to own. Own them equally, at least at the buy. How about this? Just run it as a test behind the scenes to see if your active sizing is any good. That's step number one. And no, don't feel bad if equal weighting beats you, because it wins a lot. On conviction, how's that working? All right. On optimization, some people say, Michael, well, we do an optimization. Oh, I love this. You know, optimizations, right? Simple mean variance. You have to assume the future rate of return, the future volatility, standard deviation, and the correlation. Yes? Everybody with me? If you can forecast all those correctly, then I'm saying, why are you optimizing at all? You already have the answer. This is just a lie. If you don't get all three of the inputs correct in the optimization, garbage in, garbage out. It gives you garbage out. So you shouldn't bother with this. Some people say, well, Michael, with asset classes, it's easier if we're putting together a portfolio. Well, maybe. Are you sure? Are you still forecasting returns and volatility in the correlation covariance matrix accurately? Folks, forecasting one number in the future correctly is a big enough challenge. And forecast three numbers into the future to get the answer right? Do you think that's easier? Please don't. So we're not left with a whole lot of hope there. Selling. Now notice I wrote that dog. Because you know it's a dog. Just admit it. You know, the first step is to admit. And that dog won't hunt. But selling that dog makes you grumpy. Because this is where you have to crystallize that you may have made a mistake. Right? And I just ask a simple question. So the world sees it differently than you. You think this thing was going to go up and the rest of the world is pushing it down. Why are you so convinced that you're right when the rest of the world sees it differently? Maybe just get away from the dog. Is there a trigger that says, maybe I should review this? I'd say in 80 to 90% of the teams I meet with, I reconstruct the sell discipline with them for their portfolio. That is a ridiculously high statistic. Why? Because this is the single hardest thing to do in this business, is to sell. To sell well. But there's a couple of interesting things that happens when we start talking about behavior. When your dog appears, you're trying to think, should I hold on? Should I buy more? Should I cut it? The moment you think that you are allowed to hold on, it's complicated your decision process in a way behaviorally you cannot recover from. So all I say to people is, you have two choices. You have 48 hours. Some people bargain for 72. We'll come back to that. You have 48 hours to decide, buy more or blow it out. That'll crystallize your thinking. You can't stand pat. This becomes really easy for people to execute on. 48 hours, why? Because sometimes they want to do a little more research to convince themselves that the rest of the world is wrong and they are right. No, let's not go there. All right? Track your exits. After you sell something, track it for a while. Find out if you sold well. Claire does this automatically for you. You know, she does days, I think months, but, tomato, tomato. Learning requires an exam. Better get a doc. A lot of things were talked about today. Culture, the importance. We have a tool for that to measure it in an organization, on a team. Leadership warranties a big material difference on a team. We have a tool for that. We have diagnostic tools for just about everything. But we don't do what Essentia does. So I tell my teams, because they don't have the data capabilities to do everything I suggest they need to do to find out about themselves, I send them to Claire. And she says, Michael, you need to come in and sit with the team for a few days after we give them their results. They need to be able to talk through with someone what they may be able to do with this, and that can actually ease some of the content. This is about a self-exam. Postmortems on exits. Now this is, again, now this is language again. Really important. Postmortems, as a pair of words to go, you're like thinking, oh, I can't wait to do that. Think about this for a moment. Because historically, people do postmortems only on what went wrong, right? Show me you're dead. No. Postmortems on all exits. Losers and winners. You want to find consistent patterns no matter what it was. And here's a tip. Do more of what generated winners. Do less of what generated losers. You know, the beautiful thing in the work that I do, I get to work with really smart people, but sometimes certain things seem to escape them. I don't know why. Ah, it's called ego. This got into the EQ topic from before. Track decisions. All the decisions I had you marking down, track them. Find out how accurate, how successful, how timely. Here's a couple of fun questions. So I ask you, what's your turnover rate in your portfolio? And you answer, we'll pretend we're in the long-only world because otherwise this stat won't make any sense. You say 30%. Everybody with me? 30%. I say, okay, do you know if you were to double that or have that, what would happen to your performance? And they stop. Well, then why are you turning over the portfolio at 30% then? Every single thing you do, there should be a basis. It should be intentional, shouldn't it? Or you might say, well, Michael, no, the turnover rate should be a result from all of our disciplines and our decisions. I say, I'm good with that. So then your turnover rate should vary quite a bit over time. It may hone in on something. But if we're measuring how good you're doing at selling or buying, right? Buying, I want to know batting average and I want to know slugging percentage. Can you calculate it for me? Can you show it to me? There's something measurable in everything you do. Are you paying attention? Are you tracking it? So then I want to inoculate against your bias apathy. We're just having fun with words now, folks. That is not a real word. If you're wondering, I've never seen that word before. That's correct, because I created it. Why did I create it? How do you protect? How do you inoculate the team against all of the individual biases? What if you don't? What if you stop thinking about it? What if you just make sure you create a better team? So it doesn't matter what the individual biases are, because if you create a better team and you create a better structural way to vote and approve decisions, it washes out. Well, isn't that interesting? All of this time spent on fixing biases, folks, like, can we just take a, see, I'm going to have fun with this because there's a couple neuroscientists in the room. Well, I read that stuff too, because the behavior just didn't seem to give me all the answers that I wanted. You know, here's the funny thing about behavior. You know, it's the response. So since we're all about cause and effect as human beings, what was the cause before the response? That's when you start reading neuroscience. Well, of course, then there's a cause before that, because sometimes I have to trigger all the hormonal flows in our... Hey, let's stop. All right, listen. The brain at rest consumes 20% of the body's metabolic resources. Simple as that. Brain at rest consumes 20% of the body's resources. The reason why biases exist, heuristics exist, it's an automated process to save energy in our bodies. It allows our brain to chill. It allows our brain to relax. It allows us to disengage. These are shortcuts to help because we don't want to, or at least our brain doesn't want to, do the deliberate decision-making it has to on all the little things that we come across endlessly every day. So we have these things. So you know what I say? If they're there for a good reason, why do we want to counteract them? No, we just want to manage them. So how do I talk about managing them? When you start doing all this tracking, you know what you're going to find out? You're going to find out what your predilections are. You're a little bit more prone to this, you're a little less prone to that, so forth and so on. You know what you can do after you find all that out? What I did, I created a checklist. Ooh, that's sophisticated. It's a behavioral checklist. Each question on the checklist is designed to counteract a behavioral bias. And I score them. Now we're getting really sophisticated. You know how I score them? Plus one or minus one each question. And at the end of the checklist, if there's no positive number, you know what you can't do? Can't trade. Because that decision is too biased. But you can't build that checklist to you or any member of your team until you know what their predilections are. And you can't do that until you've been tracking for a while. So we're talking about a build over time. Then you can get to something that might be the equivalent of an inoculation. Or say, oh, wow, that sounds like a lot of work, Michael. Build a diverse team and have proper decision and voting rights and don't worry about it. How about that? So we covered the seven dwarfs. Some of you may have been wondering, well, where's Snow White in this equation? Fair? Snow White's leading the team of a bunch of white males. I couldn't resist. All right, so Snow White's leading the team. Why? Because somebody has to align all of these individual ingrained habits. Each of the dwarfs represents a habit. Promote psychological safety. So, Charles introduced it at lunch. I work with it for teams. Google study, Project Aristotle. They did the research, they came up with the study, found out a Harvard professor had published on that information several years prior. Now the Harvard professor, Amy Edmondson, and Google are cooperating and working together. Wonderful. I'm going to turn. I'll do this for each side of the room, just so you can really understand the importance here. Would it be fair to say that your work, all the work that you do, is about making decisions, just generally speaking? Reasonably fair? Okay. Right. So when you as a human being do not feel safe, I'm not talking about the causation of the reasons, whatever. You don't feel safe. Right? Fight or flight. We all know this. So I'm going to turn sideways because this is important. When you have some level of fear in you, your thinking's happening inside here. Everybody with me? Can you see? Let me turn. It's happening inside here. When you're thinking well, it's happening right here. Folks, if your business is decisions, you have to have psychological safety on your team. If you don't, you have intentionally or unintentionally, I hope it's unintentional, really denigrated the quality of the thinking that's happening with your team members. And you cannot do your work the same way. See, there's a lot of fancy stuff that was talked about today and all around the research on this stuff in the industry. I try and bring it down to a level where we can all use it, because that's my job, helping teams raise their game. Add cognitive diversity. Diversity is talked about a lot. I'm not going to dive too deep unless people wish to in Q&A. Cognitive diversity is number one. Cognitive diversity gets into different thinking styles. This can be measured. And I'm not talking about Myers-Briggs. No, no. There are other ways that do a better job. But here's the point. When you have cognitive diversity and everybody on the team knows about it, you know what it does? Fascinating. It enables much better communication. When everybody knows what each other's kind of home base is, where they live personality-wise, now you know how to be effective in communicating with them. If you can raise the communication with them over time, where they are, where they're coming from, that builds trust. And that's come up a few times today. And you know where trust leads you? Trust helps build psychological safety. It all connects. You have to have people willing and able to voice disagreement. You have to have people willing and able to take risks and not feel a hammer's going to come down on them if they did it wrong. One of the teams that I've worked with has got exemplary long-term returns, has a policy of forgiveness. Have you ever heard of an investment team that has a policy of forgiveness? Yeah. Every person on that team knows that if they act within the boundaries of all of their processes and their methods for making decisions, they have no culpability on the result of the investment. Zero. You want to talk about a wonderful organization? I know when people hear about it, because I had the CEO present at a conference a couple years back, people were trying to give him resumes before he left the room, hearing about how they actually make the donuts. A policy of forgiveness on an investment team. Yeah, there's safety there. That safety has produced really good results. Which takes me to the last slide before Q&A. That's how to find me. I tweet from time to time. Some people in the room might know I maybe tweet more frequently than that. Those are my three books. The one in the middle came out on Amazon about 2 days ago. The one, Let's All Learn How to Fish, CFA Institute Research Foundation, publication from 2016. The one in the middle is the rest of the story from 2016. Little did I know the story wasn't done in 2016 when I wrote the damn book, and I had to write one more. I'm done now. It's not happening again. And then my partners and I wrote Money, Meaning, and Mindsets. What we do is we work with investment firms, and it's not about the quantitative, although I go there. It's about the people. And if the people feel safe, you will get the most that you can get out of them. And if the team is diverse, I would argue you don't have to worry about the biases as much, which is wonderful, because good luck. Human nature evolved them. You're not getting rid of them. So maybe it's okay. Maybe we just have to care much more deeply about continuous improvement and go through every step of what we do to make the donuts every day and see what data we can find. See if each one is at its best. I do question diagnostics with teams, and I'll put up, click all that you consistently add alpha from. Are you ready for this? I put buying, I put sizing, I put selling, I put holding. If I want to be a little bit more creative, I'll add a couple choices that are a little like trims and adds. Don't bother. All right. Buying, sizing, selling, holding. I say, okay, weigh in. Which of these, any of these four, you click all four, you consistently add alpha from. Team after team after team, asset class after asset class after asset class. Tell me, because you know the answers, which are the two big bars, histograms of the votes? Time and time again. Buying, sizing, selling, holding. Which are the two big bars of votes? Shout it out. Buying and not selling stuff. No! Holding. Forgive me, those that are hedgies in the room. Nothing against you, but a lot of my clients are long only. Buying and holding. And often sizing and selling get no votes whatsoever. So I say, so you are acknowledging that you're pretty good at buying. You're really good at holding. I have a story there, real quick one. But you're not good at sizing or selling. What if we can improve sizing and selling? Do you think your results might improve? Yes, let's do that. And I spend a lot of time in those areas with teams. Really good, another money manager story. A big European investor wanted to hire them, asked for all their data. Wasn't essentially to sell that, it just wanted their raw data. CIO sent all the data. Gets a call from the potential investor. I've analyzed all your data, and I'm trying to understand what's going on here, because your long-term record is phenomenal, but you don't seem to be particularly good at buying. You don't seem to be particularly good at sizing, and you don't seem to be particularly good at selling. So how do I square the circle? How are you generating good long-term numbers? He's like, well, I don't know how you did the analysis and what you're looking at, but that sounds like it might be accurate. He's like, huh? How can that be accurate and you have good? Because you forgot one thing that we're really, really good at. He goes, what's that? We buy great companies, and we don't ever sell them. We just hold. On average, each year, they add one or two names to their portfolio. That's it. Average holding period is almost 10 years, and their long-term returns are phenomenal. But they know these companies backwards, forwards, inside out, upside down, right side up, every which way. Folks, there's a lot of different ways you can make money in this business. Everybody's focused on buying. Sizing estimates upwards of quarter to a half sharp ratio point if you do it well. Selling on average estimates of up to 100 basis points per annum if you do it better. Think about the statistics of what can happen if you can do each part of your processes well. And get everybody people-wise on board, because the culture and the EQ matters. I'm done. The bar may be open. I don't know if there are questions. Thank you. So the question for those who couldn't hear is, how do you suss out, how do you separate someone who has conviction versus someone who demonstrates? They should connect, right? So conceptually, if someone has a lot of conviction, it should be a bigger position in the portfolio. There should be a correlation with size. And the only time that wouldn't be is if there's a prohibition against a certain sector or a certain level of liquidity, something along those lines. But there should be a direct, you should be able to look at the holdings and say, this clearly was conviction, this maybe not. I'm not certain it matters a lot. What I care more about is, do you have a high level of confidence that you know everything that you should know about this company? Or this security, right? If it's a bond, it's working with bond managers on a sell discipline, oh, is that entertaining? That's just separately as a note. Because they just want to hold till maturity. But they correlate. So I'm not sure we have to separate them, is my response. So your topic is one of career risk, right? Bad numbers, may lose your job. Yeah, this is a massive, it's not the monkey on the back in the industry, it's the gorilla on the back. In fact, I may have a paper coming out very, very shortly on the topic of career risk and psychological safety with a collaborator. It's not easy. It's not easy because if you're going to persist in this industry, you have to be able to produce alpha. It's that simple. But the question is, are we measuring decisions? Because I think in terms of a four square, if you'll give me a second here, you've got good process or a lack of good process on one side, a good outcome or a bad outcome, or a less than good outcome. Fair? Right? You can have good process and a bad outcome. That would be called bad luck. You can have bad process and a good outcome, that would be called dumb luck. You with me? Right? Then we've got good process, good outcome, that we might call that rewardable, right, from a compensation or a bonus standpoint. And then you've got the final box. Bad process, bad outcome, that's called poetic justice. Right? Score every decision. Right? Pick. Which box does it go in? Don't punish bad luck. Don't reward dumb luck. So there are things that we could do to start accumulating better insight and forgiveness. You know, before you throw somebody under the bus, say, listen, how's it going? Do you need any help? Is there additional training we can get you? Right? So support people until and unless you figure out this is just not the right job for them. Some people just can't do the work. We don't want to punish them by continuing them in the work that they're not good at. Right? That's like owning that dog that you refuse to sell. Do you know what happens when you refuse to sell a dog that's barking at you? It takes up a bigger and bigger and bigger mind share. Think about that for a second. That's all you can think about. Let it go. And you will feel much better. Other questions, or should we just go right to cocktails? I just go right to cocktails. About the big data issue from earlier. Oh, so the personality tool that we use is called the Enneagram. For those who maybe, let me spell it, some may not know it. Enneagram. It's an ancient tool that's been around, I mean, like 2,000 years ancient. In the 1950s, a bunch of psychologists got a hold of it and decided to test it to see if it had efficacy. And it's brilliant. It works. So three people on my team are certified in this, and we regularly type teams that we're working with or help them. And it's amazing how it helps the team communicate better. It is absolutely amazing. Because when I understand that your home base is, you know, over here, and I'm over here, you're not being difficult or obstructionist to me. You see things different. So can I use a simple example? This table, right? Enneagram has nine main types. Around this table, let's say we had nine chairs. I put a centerpiece in the middle of the table that looks different on each side. Each person sees the centerpiece differently. Now, if you can allow that on your team to have a team that sees this differently, but they have a way to communicate together and aggregate the votes, like in a market, now you've done something very positive. So we use the tool a lot. My colleagues actually published a book on it that you can go to our website and look at it and get it. Ooh, defense, defense. When someone doesn't feel safe, the first step is to find out what's bugging them, what's bothering them, what is challenging their feeling of security, and then talk through it to find out how much of it is real or imagined or perceived. And then often there's somebody on the other side. It may be time for some form of a mediation or a conversation with two people. I've got a guy that I'm just starting to coach right now. I do that a little bit. And he's a big guy. He's like this. And one of the colleagues on his team is a woman who's like this big. And I've been in a room where he will address her. Why don't you want to talk to me? I don't like talking to you. And there's become a real rub between the two of them. And then I got a call. Can you help him? And I'm not certain it's just him. Let me just say it that way. From the initial conversations, time will tell. But the first step is try and unpack it. What is actually making that person feel less secure? Because sometimes that can be about them and not necessarily about anybody else. But trust me when I say I've been in a bunch of organizations where I understand why people don't feel safe. It's kind of in the air, and that's a cultural issue then. Then you got to work at the overall team, the overall organization's culture. I don't know. I get paid and I leave. No. You know, a funny thing happens with my clients. They ask me to come back. A year later, 6 months later, 2 years later, they're like, you know, we've been changing some things. We want you to come kick the tires. Just a short version. Let's just do a test. But the proof is in the pudding. This is where, you know, listen, you're a data guy, and I so appreciate that. I get a lot of teams who come back and say, oh my, Michael, since you were out, our numbers, our performance just improved dramatically. Thank you. I said, you can't thank me for that. They're saying because I visited, they did some new things, and their performance improved. I said, did you ever think that maybe you hired me at the trough of what was going on with your style? Right? Or the height of problems on your team? Folks, I can't tell you that I can improve your performance. I can tell you I can bias it a lot better. But I can't tell you I can improve it because time period, context, team members, it all matters. My work I call PP&E, philosophy, process, and execution. That's my project, PP&E. Execution, the E, that's all about people on the team working together. It's not about the trade execution. It's about decision execution. And I spend most of my time in the E more so than the P in the P when I'm doing my work. And I love it because I don't work with digits. I don't work with data. I work with human beings. And it's so entertaining. I'll leave it at that. Thank you all.